Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 20th, 2006. Our session today is entitled Mao Zedong and the Chinese Revolution. Our presenter is Van J. Simmons. Session number SYV2006-2. Let's listen in.
The time is of essence. There just isn't enough of it. My name is Van Simmons. I'm a teacher at Augustana College, and my wife, bless her, is the accompanist to the choir. So she's the reason I'm here. I came along, tagged along with Ruth, and we've enjoyed being with the choir students. And this is our first trip to Holden. I've taught at Augustana for 27 years. I've heard all my colleagues talk about what a wonderful place this is. And I believe them, but I never managed to make the trip, and here I am.
You believe them now?
I do. This is very special. Paul honored me the other day. I just finished doing the dishes. This was yesterday. And he says, "How was it?" And I said, "It was grand." And I started talking all about all the people I was working with, and he looked at me and he says, "Man," he says, "you're a Holden man." And I thought that was just the greatest of compliments. Yeah, so I feel really a part of this community. Yesterday I introduced the students that were with me to a quite remarkable book, and I want to pass it around in hopes that you'll buy it and read it. It's one of the most impressive books on the nature of governance that I've ever read. Harold Bloom says of this book, Emperor of China, Jonathan Spence tries to write an autobiography for the Kangxi Emperor. Harold Bloom says, "I am moved and delighted. It is one of the rarest of books. Most readers will be deeply haunted by it and will study their own nostalgias with fresher insight because of it. It may be a permanent literary achievement." Theodore White said of it, "A masterpiece that lifts scholarship to a new level of beauty. An unforgettable portrait of a great man never before known to the West." It really is quite a remarkable book that touches on just a whole range of aspects of the challenges of governance. And what I want to do with you today is continue on that theme and introduce the class to yet another book. And this one, I think, is equally striking. I don't know if any of you have read this before. It came out about a decade ago, The Private Life of Chairman Mao. It was written by a fellow named Li Jersui. Mr. Li was the private doctor of the chairman. He was educated in the West and persuaded, as many people educated in the West were persuaded after the 49 Revolution, to return to China to serve his fatherland. The picture of Mr. Li when he was young. And he went back to China and became Mao's personal physician. And then he, in the late 80s, after he'd gone through much of the trauma that other people had, but viewing them from the court instead of as an ordinary person, he made his way to Chicago to live with his daughter and was persuaded by his wife, who was dying of cancer, to write his reflections on life with Chairman Mao. And it is an incredibly revealing book about rulership, about the chairman, but more striking about the ability of power to corrupt an individual. Many of us who have studied Mao Zedong find in him a young man, a quite striking revolutionary. One I remember was a college-age kid who I could really identify. That was the 60s. But we didn't really know the real Mao. I think as a young man, he had much that was endearing about him. As an old man, he was a tyrant, a self-centered egomaniac, a really evil man. And this story will convey that to you. And I want to explore that with you. The Mao on the scales of history and who he was and what led him to the point where he ended up. So I'll pass this around. You can take a look at this. It's really a striking story. I should tell you that right shortly after this book was published, two interesting things happened. One, I attended an Association for Asian Studies meeting, That's the professional organization that's kind of the umbrella for those of us who study Asia. And it was the most striking session I've ever attended in all my years as an academic. There was a plenary session, and Rodney McFarker, Lu Xinpai, Stuart Schramm, people that really count in the field, who had made their career by writing about Mao Zedong, and to a certain extent, justifying what he was doing to the Western world, sat in front of all of us and apologized because they had got it wrong. It was just an incredible experience because this book told us so much and we did get it wrong. And so that was just, for me, a really telling experience. And then another reflection on this book too, the impact of it. A few years after that, I was traveling in China with a group of Augustana students. Every third year we take 80 of them to Asia for 11 weeks, and we spent 6 weeks in China traveling with them. And I was on the train sitting next to our CITS national guide. And they had, at that time, they had access to more reading than most ordinary Chinese citizens. And I just started a conversation, and I said, have you heard about this new book that's just been published? And he says, he was rather proud. He could say, yeah, I've read it. And then he looked at me, and he says, but it's all lies. It's a book that was contrived in Taiwan to denigrate our great chairman. And I said, why do you think it was produced in Taiwan? And he said, because the Chinese is Taiwan Chinese. And I looked at him and I said, you know why that is? And he says, yeah, because the CIA and the Taiwan elements have produced this book. I said, no. It's because the book was first published in the United States and the Taiwan Chinese translated it from English into Chinese. So of course it would be Taiwan Chinese. And I said, I've been to conferences. I know that this is a valid depiction. Well, ultimately what happens is the Chinese have to deal with the stories that are told here by Li Zhurshui. And they came to terms with Mao shortly after his death. He died in 76, and the Politburo, about 82 I guess it was, made an official pronouncement on the legacy of Mao Zedong. Remember, the Cultural Revolution had occurred from 66 to 76. It ends only when Mao dies. And then 4 or 5 years later, the Gang of Four have now been tried and thrown into prison. Deng Xiaoping, the moderate, the pragmatist, has emerged. Remember, he came to the States. Do you remember when that happened? Quite an incredible story. And I think the visit to the States transformed him. And he became a pragmatist even more. He's the fellow that said, it doesn't matter what color the cat is, as long as it catches mice. It doesn't have to be a red cat. It can be a black cat. If it catches mice, it'll work. And he said, to get rich is glorious. Well, Deng's in control, and they need to put Mao behind them. And so the Politburo makes an official assessment. And what they argued is that Mao Zedong was 70% good and 30% bad. Okay? That's the final statement on Mao. What was he good for? We'll talk about that. Why would they, the Chinese Politburo, the leaders of that Politburo themselves, argue that there was 30% that was bad in Mao? He should be judged for his shortcomings. In part, it's what Li Zhurshui is writing about. But the two major events in Mao's life that led people to brand him as bad were the Great Leap Forward and the Great Proletarian Culture Revolution. there were bad things that came out of these two events. Do any of you remember the Great Leap Forward? What it was about?
So they tried to have little iron furnaces in every backyard and everything.
Why did you do that?
The people involved, I guess.
It's Holden Village.
Yeah.
So aren't we talking about that? But it's Holden Village run amok. He wanted people to have an experience producing steel and iron. He wanted to catch up with Great Britain in steel production by the end of the century. China didn't have the infrastructure other countries had. They had one thing that was surplus, and that was labor.
People.
At that time, probably 800 million people. Most of them rural. There's a period of time when they're needed to plant the rice or the wheat or sorghum or whatever and to harvest it, but there are long periods of time when they're idle. And the idea of the Great Leap Forward is to use that untapped energy, that untapped labor. And you do that by organizing people in communes. First they were organized just in work units and cooperatives, but then they created communes of about, on the average, about 20,000 people. Big enterprises. And then the other key was liberating women. Women were bound to the house to raise children. So they just said, we'll solve that. We'll put all the children in nurseries, and we'll create communal mess halls, and then the women can go out and farm the fields. And if the women are farming the fields, then the men will be liberated to do public works, really. We'll have them build roads, improve the irrigation systems, level mountains and build terraces so we can plant new crops and so on and so forth. The other key to the Great Leap Forward, and the other reason Mao launched this endeavor, was he wanted direct access to the people. By this time, he'd become suspicious of his own party and the bureaucracy that was running China. He felt that the bureaucracy was corrupt and ineffective. If you create communes, you don't need provincial governors. You don't need district magistrates. You don't need intermediaries. You just have a commune leadership that is directly answerable to the state. And so it was a power grab by Mao, as well as it was Mao implementing what he regarded as a utopian vision. I think to a degree his intents were good at this time, but the whole thing went awry. Have any of you studied the aftermath of the Great Leap? We've only just begun to consider it. We in the West had little idea of the disaster of the Great Leap. And it's only been in the last decade that the Chinese have begun to talk about it. The disaster was, as women went to the fields and men went off on public works, the fields didn't get planted as they should have, or harvested in due fashion. And there were all kinds of harebrained schemes to increase production. If putting this many seeds down on a plot of land produces this much grain, why don't we put three times as many seeds down and get three times as much grain? And the central planners were dictating this in various parts of the country. So there were all kinds of failed experiments that were introduced into agriculture and imposed on the local level. The farmers had been planting for years. They knew how to do it and get the best yield they could. But the impositions came from above. And then these commune leaders, they caught the spirit, and they all determined that if Mao said we could increase production by 20% and send that grain abroad to secure revenue, to build industry, we were going to do it. And so the spirit of the Great Leap was communal endeavors to produce more. And people were working 16-hour days and then spending 4 hours studying Mao Zedong thought and sleeping 4 hours, then getting up the next day and doing it. And they did that for 3 years and just wore out. But what happened was the cadre, once they had stated that they would produce 20% more, felt obligated, in fact, to produce that. And when they didn't, they still claimed. And then the neighbor would produce 25 and then 30. And the commune leaders were declaring that they were producing twice what they produced. And the government was collecting taxes on the grain that they supposed or were willing to accept was actually being produced. And the grain flowed out of the countryside. There was sufficient grain in some parts of the country, but it flowed out of the countryside to validate the cadres' statements of what they produced. Mm-hmm. And the peasants were left with nothing. It's in the richest provinces of China, where the cadre were most zealous, that the famine struck the hardest. And it's estimated, and these are quite valid estimates, that between 20 to 30 million people died of starvation in China between 59 and 62. That could have been prevented if the cadre had been willing to fess up to what they were doing. Moving from the second to the third year of the Great Leap, the central government had begun to realize that the miracle wasn't happening, but Mao imposed his will and said, we will continue the Great Leap. One of his great generals, Peng Dehui, a Korean, the leader of Chinese forces in the Korean War, confronted Mao at a conference in Lushun and said, we should back off the Great Leap. And Mao forced him out of power. So Mao, to protect his own pride and his own image, continued the Great Leap until China was about ready to collapse in the end. Absolute disaster, a man-made disaster that didn't need to happen, that continued because Mao was unwilling to let it go, and 20 to 30 million people died. People at that time were organized into work units, into organizations called danwei. And unless you were in a danwei, you had no public services. That meant that, for me, my danwei would have been Augustana College. And Augustana College would have provided me with housing, it would have provided me with healthcare, it would have provided me with a salary, an income, with work. If I didn't belong to that danwei, I had no resources to fall back on. So when people began to starve, they had nowhere to go. They couldn't flee rural China and move to Shanghai because they didn't have the pass to move. You couldn't move freely in China. They had no danwei to move to, so if they got to Shanghai, they'd starve anyway. And people just laid down. Tragic. Well, that happens from 50. This is one of the reasons he's 30% bad. That's a pretty good reason.
I'd say he may be higher.
What?
He'd be higher than that.
Yeah. Well, many of us believe that. And then the next reason is 66 to 76. Mao, after the failed Great Leap Forward, was slowly shunted out of power, quite amazingly so, by Deng and Zhou Enlai and Liu Shaoqi and some of the other key pragmatic leaders in the government. And he withdrew from Beijing and went down to Wuhan on the Yangtze River and lived. I've been to the villa that he was in. He moved to this villa in Wuhan, right on one of the Dongjing Lake. Just a beautiful place by Chinese standards. They air conditioned it by bringing big blocks of ice and putting in this one room and then blowing fans over the ice, all kinds of things to make Mao comfortable. Well, he moved down there and then got testing. He didn't like not being in power. And the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution was about Mao's reassertion of power. Do you have memories of that?
That's really...
What are your memories of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution there?
Having educated, paraded through streets with chain.
Yeah. The tall pointed hats.
Pointed hats.
You know, the airplane position. And, the intellectuals were just brutalized. It was Orwellian in a sense. When the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution broke out, I was in Hong Kong. It was just beginning to break out. And we didn't know much about it, except there were bodies floating down the Pearl River. And so we knew something was up. And I can remember the electricity in the air of Hong Kong. This would have been the fall of 66. I was walking down the street one day with a friend, and we saw across the street on Nathan Road a theater, and people were just queued up to go into the theater. And the billboard read, "The Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution." And I wasn't reading the paper very much at the time. I was a young representative for my church and wasn't supposed to even be into reading papers, so I wasn't. But we had one diversion day, and we could go to select movies, and I looked at my friend and said, "Let's go see what that's about. It must be interesting. All the Chinese are lined up there." And we walked into that theater. And there was kind of a short before that, and it was a story in Chinese of the Sino-Japanese War. It was a charming thing, where the Chinese were ambushing the Japanese when they came in and everything. That was to get everybody excited. But then the movie itself was, you've seen pictures of this, the demonstrations in Beijing where the students came to be audienced by Mao. And I can remember still the electricity. We were the only two Westerners in that theater. And I can remember how foreign I felt. And I can remember as we walked out, people with the red badges, people looking at us as, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" And I wasn't sure what I was doing. The Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution was the effort made by Mao to reassert himself. He had no trust in the party, because the party had shunted him aside. Because of the failure of the Great League. He wasn't sure of the support of the military, though Li Peng had Li Peng is a fellow that was instrumental in the Tiananmen crisis. He placed a marshal in control of the military, but he still wasn't too certain of it. So what he did was he just said, "Making revolution is glorious." And young people now at 66 haven't had a revolutionary experience, so we're going to give them one. And he hands them the little red book and he says, "Study my thought and go out and create havoc. Turn over anything that's old, anything that's bad, anything that's Western, destroy it." And the young people did just that. They had free rail passes. They were to be cared for by the people wherever they went, and they went out and just brutalized the countryside. People like Deng Xiaoping, the fellow that emerges after Mao's death, and Deng was sent off to the countryside. Liu Shaoqi, who was the second in command in China at the start of the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, and Mao had come to view him as a threat, was seized by the Red Guards. His wife was lured out of Zhongnanhai, the place where the Politburo members lived, because her daughter had been seized by the Red Guards. And they lured her out of there, and she came out to save her daughter, and they seized her, and then they seized Liu. And Liu died in the Cultural Revolution. He had several health problems. The students brutalized him, and then just left him to die. They took him into the countryside and left him in a little room on the floor, and he just died. It was a horrific thing. It was Orwellian in that context of Big Brother and doing what he wishes. And that's the second reason that why people deem Mao to be bad. These two things. But still, there's 70% of him that's good. The irony of this is, when you go to China today and you get in the cab, how many of you have been to China? Okay. Have you ever been in one of these cabs where the cab driver will either have some kind of Buddhist amulet, which is a contradiction, isn't it, in an atheistic country, but there is the Guanyin Buddha or something, or they'll have Mao Zedong hanging on their mirror. And you say, "Well, I thought Mao was disgracing." "Oh, no, Mao brings you good luck." So Mao's been deified in China. And these people are ambivalent. They're 30% bad, but Mao is still a person to be venerated. If you go to Tiananmen Square, you have the opportunity to line up and go see Mao Zedong. He's there, lying in state. Every morning, people queue up for, they fill the square. They queue up for, it can be several hundred yards. And they walk you in through the front door. People buy plastic flowers and they put it on his grave site. They walk you in through the front door, and then they split you this way, and Mao's in state right here. And you walk through, and you view his body, much as was the case with Lenin in this tomb. Mm-hmm. And there's this homage to Mao. They don't quite know how to let go of this man. One of the most interesting parts of this book by Li Zhisui is the first chapter, in which he talks about getting a phone. Well, he was in attendance when Mao died of about 18 different ailments. I mean, it was inevitable he was going to die, primarily of Lou Gehrig's disease. But shortly after he dies, the Politburo makes a determination that they are going to preserve Mao for state, as Lenin had been preserved. And Li Zhisui, there's a factional struggle going on in the court, and Li's right there, all this going around him. And one branch of that faction is saying, we need to preserve his body, do it. And Li Zhisui says, I don't know how to preserve a body for state. I mean, Lenin's body's been around for 70 years. And they said, well, get in touch with the Russians. Let's figure out how to do this. So Li Zhisui gets in touch with the Soviet Union, and they just laugh. They say, oh, Lenin's nose fell off years ago. There's no way you can preserve a body. But he's had this decree, and this is a totalitarian state, and if it doesn't work, he's in real trouble. So what does he do? What would you do if you were a doctor and you needed to preserve Mao for state for the next several decades?
He
thought, couldn't we do this in wax? They said, no. He pumped them full of formaldehyde. But he didn't know how much to put in there. As you read the story, it was 30 or 40 liters. So much so that, I mean, they had him just full of formaldehyde. And then he says, and then a problem happened. He began to inflate. And he said, and the state, the first visitations were the next day. And he said, we had this corpse out here, and we were massaging it to get the formaldehyde back to where it should be, it could be hidden in the body. And then we draped the flag over him, and he looked a little puffy, but it was close enough. So anytime I go through Mao's mausoleum now, I wonder, well, is this wax, or is this that formaldehyde-laden corpse? I digress.
You got Ho Chi Minh in state in Hanoi.
Yes. And I wonder. Well, I wanted to set context here, and I've done so by talking about the shortcomings of Mao. And I want to focus towards the end of the hour that we have on what it is that led Mao from, I think, good to bad. Let me set context, and then I want to just open it up for discussion. In 1927, Mao was a young revolutionary. The party had been founded in 1921. And Mao had made his way from Hunan province in the middle of the Yangtze Basin to Beijing. And there he'd say, he didn't have the connections. He probably had the brains, but not the connections to get into Beijing University. So he'd become a librarian and the assistant librarian to one of the co-founders of the Chinese Communist Party. Chen Duxiu and Li Dajiao were the co-founders of the party. Chen was an English professor. Paul will tell you their revolutionary. Li was a historian, and I'll tell you their revolutionary. But they were a librarian, historian, and English professor. And very often in China, students they had very personal relations with their teachers, and they would follow the lead of their teachers. And I think Mao was introduced to Marxist-Leninism by Li Dajiao, and became a communist. And then by 27, 6 years after, is a kind of a becoming a more pivotal figure in the revolution, though he doesn't emerge as a central figure in the communist movement until 1935. Well, he's sent off to the countryside to examine peasant uprisings that are occurring in Hunan province, his home province. And he writes for what is, for me, the most interesting essay that he ever wrote, and the one to which I most identify. And it was entitled An Investigation of the Peasant Movement in Hunan. At that time, peasants were organizing themselves into cooperatives and seizing the land. They were doing it without any organization from above. The landlords controlled the land and the peasants were taking it back. It was a chaotic period of time. The revolution had occurred, the Qing dynasty had fallen, the warlord governments were laced throughout China. And so the peasants had some freedom they didn't have before. And they were taking landlords and killing them. And Mao went down. The directive from the Comintern, the Communist International in Russia, and they were leading the infant communist movement in China, was put a lid on the peasants. Don't let the jackery get out of hand. We can't control the peasants. The movement, the communist movement, will be led by who? Who leads a communist movement? In classical Marxist terms? The proletariat, yeah. If the peasants get out of line, the proletariat will be scared away and will not have a revolution. Or a counter-revolution will occur. Chiang Kai-shek and the Americans, the imperialists, kind of just stamp us out. Put a lid on the peasants. So Mao sent down there to figure out what the peasants are doing and then write back and say, here's what we need to do. Mao goes down and he writes this wonderful essay in which he analyzes the situation. And he says, he basically says, folks, it's happening. The peasants are rising, and the old injustices are being rectified. He talked about 14 great achievements of the peasant cooperatives. And it sounds like a puritanical movement. The old Puritans, what are they? They're limiting the number of meat, the amount of meat people can eat in their meals, the number of dishes they can. They're limiting the size of weddings because people are spending all their money marrying their daughters off or burying their dead people. And so there are limitations on the money you can spend marrying and burying people. The other achievements, they stopped opium smoking in the countryside. I talked about that the other day, the introduction of opium. It was everywhere in China. They just put an end to that. You smoke opium, you die, and people stop smoking. And so there were these 14 achievements. But right then he says, you know, this movement's going to happen whether we lead it or not. We can stand back and try to stop it, or we can stand back and just observe it and let them do their thing and not be critical, or we can lead them. And he says, we need to lead this peasant movement. If you're wondering what Mao's claim to greatness is, and being a hero in history, it's because he claims to be the first person to recognize the revolutionary potential of the peasant. Lenin, and we'll talk about him later this week, Lenin argued that a revolution needed to be proletarian-based, didn't he? Was Lenin's revolution proletarian-based? No. Not a chance. It was run by disillusioned intellectuals, and they bring out a proletarian once in a while and put him out on the podium so everybody believed that the proletarian were doing this. But his argument was that the revolution would be created because the workers were being exploited by the capitalists, the industrialists, and they would rise up and throw off this tyranny. Well, Mao said the peasants had the same potential. And then he said, and this is a quote you've heard, he said, a revolution is not a dinner party. It cannot be so refined and genteel. A revolution is an act by which one people take power from another people. And the landlords aren't of their own volition just going to give their land to the poor peasants. They've got to take it. And he said 70% of the people in this province are poor peasants. They have no land. 70% of rural Hunan province had not a stitch of land. They were serving as tenant farmers, and that meant giving 50 or 60% of what they produced to whoever owned the land they farmed, or they were working just as itinerant laborers. They were dirt poor. And he says, these people have nothing to lose in being revolutionary, and they're going to take what they deserve. And then he goes on in this wonderful rhetoric. He's a very fine writer. Of course, his works have been edited by, I don't know how many, dozen people before they come to press, but he writes about how the peasant revolutionaries are clear-sighted. They know who the evil tyrants and gentry are, and it's only those real evil gentry that are being rounded up and executed. The others, they deal with in other ways. So they keep clear records, and they're just people. And if we don't lead them, someone else will, or they'll just do it on their own, so let's get on with this. I don't think Mao was enough of a communist to know that he was preaching heresy here. He was just revealing what he saw. And so if you talk about Mao 70% good, you go back to 27 and the vision he had. Any of you heard about the Long March? Mm-hmm. What is it about?
Getting away from the Japanese in World War II.
Not the Japanese. From Chiang Kai-shek. It happens in 35 and 36. It marks the rise of Mao. This is when he emerges in power. Prior to that time, the party had been controlled really by the Kuomintang. Any of you taken a long hike this week?
Not yet.
I went up to Lyman Lake on Sunday with two of my students. 18 miles. Boy, was I tired when I got back. The Long March was a 366-day exodus from central China, from Hunan, all the way up to northwest China, through the western part of China, this really mountainous area that is really the eastern part of Tibet. They climbed mountains every bit like these, up to 16,000 feet. And they were in a pitched battle every week. They were being attacked the whole trek. They traveled in 366 days, 6,000 miles, mostly on foot. Mao had a donkey, he rode. That averages out to 16 miles a day, I figured it out. Can you imagine hiking to Lyman Falls and then getting up the next morning and hiking another 16 miles and another without this nice place to come back to and food on the table? It is truly one of the great treks in history. It matches Hannibal's march, or Napoleon's invasion into Russia and flight back, or the Trail of Tears, the Cherokee. Is it Cherokee?
Only Moses has a feet.
I bet he does.
But he was very slow at it.
Yeah, it took him a little longer, didn't it? Well, what I'm saying is, when we talk about 70% good in Mao Zedong, we talk about his realization that the peasant could be revolutionary, his leadership during the Long March. He's given credit, though probably overly so, with the defeat of the Japanese in the Second World War. We often claim credit, don't we, because of Pearl Harbor and everything else. But you've got to realize that half of Japanese forces during the Second World War were bogged down in China. Our war in the Pacific would have been much more intense and not half of those troops been bogged down in China. They weren't all being fought by the people sympathetic to the communists, because the Kuomintang was in the southern part of China. But he takes claim, really, for the guerrilla warfare strategy and whatnot that led to the defeat of the Japanese. So he's got a lot of reasons for people to say, yeah, this is a great man in history. Well, I said context. What are your impressions of this man? And how should he be judged in history?
Well, what period of time was he push for the population growth?
Right after 49. When the communists took power in 1949, it's estimated there were about 450 million people in China. Since then, they've doubled again, 1.3 billion. But they've had a one-child policy, you see. After the Great Leap, they introduced the one-child policy, which is a troubling development for many of us, but we realize the imperative nature of doing that too. And my friends that have one child, even if it's one child and she's a girl, I still realize the essential nature of it. Now, Mao is the person that said, we can expand our agriculture to meet a growing population. You've got to realize that have you heard of Sun Yat-sen? The George Washington people say of China. When he wrote his Three People's Principles, the most popular of his three principles was the principle of nationalism. And as part of that principle, he said, we need to be careful in China because the West is growing too quickly. And they're going to exceed us in population in a very short time. And they will no longer have the strength that we do. So even Sun felt that it was important to increase population, not just Mao. What are your impressions of Mao and on the scales of history?
I think in 50 years he'll be credited for starting China on the path to being the dominant superpower in the world.
Should he be credited with that, or should Deng Xiaoping and the pragmatists who succeeded him?
He don't know.
Yeah, he got him started. He didn't have all the right ideas, but you know, he developed the spirit that they could, by golly, be a superpower.
I think it's
he kicked American butt in Korea.
Yes, he did. Mao, the first policies of the communist government right after 49 were based on Soviet formulas. And it was to develop heavy industry first and then lesser industries and agriculture second. And so that in the 50s, people didn't have radios or fans or anything. The basic commodities weren't being produced because everything was going into steel production, rail lines and communications and everything. And agriculture was being taxed to pay for that industrial development. That was the formula that had worked for the Soviet Union. So Mao can be given credit for the early development of heavy industry. But then in after the 50s, you have this abortive commune system. And I don't think we can credit Mao with the miracle of capitalist China. I really think that the credit for that belongs to Liu Shaoqi and Deng and others. So that's not the one thing that I would I mean, what he did was he drove out the West, drove out the imperialists, he gave China, reunified China from warlord government, and got rid of Chiang Kai-shek. And the Chinese will view him as the liberator of China, not just from Japanese dominance, but also because he forced the Westerners out. And as I suggested the other day, from 1841 on, from the Opium War on, the omnipresence of the West had just been insidious, been terrible. Right?
You, as a historian, may know all those names, including Zhang, but who's going to remember those names in terms of the general public? Mao.
To his credit, neither Zhou Enlai or Deng Xiaoping, Zhou Enlai was the diplomat, the great eminence, and Deng was the little guy from Sichuan who came to America and then implemented this change. Neither of them wanted to be glorified in their deaths. They didn't want their works published. They had seen what a tyranny grew around the cult of Mao. I mean, the sun rose and the sun set because Mao allowed it to do so. And he was the great helmsman that led China. If we don't remember them, it's because they consciously chose not to do that. But we do still have this question of, when we remember Mao, do we remember him for good or ill? I don't know. Any other observations about Mao and his legacy for us in history?
I think for me, what I remember most is the Cultural Revolution and the absolute destruction of culture as such, the culture of historical China, as well as contemporary culture that had entered into China. Everything but, you know, what represented the experience of students.
To put it in context, let me suggest to you that it's never easy for an underdeveloped country in an imperialist world to modernize and deal with the threat posed by the West. And that China reeled from the incursion of the West from the mid-19th century. So much so that right at about the time the Communist Party was being established in 21, there was a movement called the May 4th movement. It occurred in 1919, and it was a response to the betrayal of China at the Versailles peace treaties. Woodrow Wilson had promised the Chinese and all nations that at the end of the First World War, governments would receive their sovereignty again, that the great powers of the world would deal with the rest of the world differently. And what that meant to the Chinese is that at Versailles, the Americans and the French and the British and others would force the Japanese to withdraw from Shandong, a peninsula they had occupied during the war. And they had had some assurances that that would happen. At Versailles, that didn't happen. The old boys got together and kind of split the world up again. And the outcome of that was the May 4th movement, where students simply demonstrated, much as they did in Tiananmen in 1989, that there had to be change. The government had to respond in some effective way. And out of this May 4th movement, there were slogans like, down with the old, up with the new, down with Confucius and Sons. The spirit of the great proletarian cultural revolution, the attack on the old, began as early as 1919, or even earlier than that, because there was this sense that if people held on to traditional values, they would never successfully make the dramatic change they had to make in order to not be overrun by the imperialists. The driving force was that. Okay, so he's playing off this historical context, but he does it in a poor way. I mean,
okay, the question becomes that once you've got the revolution, on what values then do you continue after the revolution? And I think Mao attempted to deal with that in some fashion, albeit wrongly, in the Great Cultural Revolution. To what extent was Confucianism, is Confucianism, part of the heart and soul of what China is, and perhaps should be?
I'll tell you another story. About 15 years ago, I was in Beijing. The students were off, they had a free day. And I rented a bicycle and headed to the north part of Beijing to see a temple that is the redoubt of Tibet Buddhists. I wanted to go up and hear them chant and everything. But right close to that temple is the old Confucian examination center from the Qing Dynasty. And I wanted to see what was left of Confucianism. So I went up to the Tibetan temple, and it was vibrant and alive, but orchestrated, because the communists are orchestrating that whole thing, as you know. And then I went over to the Confucian temple. There was nothing going on there. I went in. I went back to the back. It was a traditional Confucian courtyard. Went back to the back, and I could see enclosed in some chicken wire some kind of implements of what would have been Confucian ceremonial instruments and garb and whatnot. But there was no sense that Confucianism had any life at all in China. If anything, the site of Confucius's birthplace in Shandong has been rebuilt. It was attacked during the Great Proletarian Culture Revolution. It's been rebuilt as a tourist site. As far as I can tell, Confucianism is pretty much dead. And I think that's unfortunate. But that's the toll of this need for change. Revolutionaries, be they Marxist or be they Democrats, they're just fearful that China's going to be overrun by the West. They argued that in Confucianism, you had a system where men abused women because in the Confucian system of justice, women are dealt with differently than men by the law. A man can divorce a wife on any pretext imaginable. And there are examples of a woman who served her mother-in-law tepid tea and her husband divorced her. But a woman cannot divorce a husband under any grounds. It was a system based on five cardinal relationships, and they were hierarchical relationships. And people came to realize that they just simply I don't know whether Confucianism will be revived.
Maybe it shouldn't be, but I suppose my question is, one can rebel against Westernism, mm-hmm. but capitalism, particularly the kind of capitalism I think that's growing in China, is very Western.
I know.
and in many ways very destructive.
I know. There are a lot of us worried about it. Walmart is in China, and it's scary, because all these little mom-and-pop stores are just going to be destroyed.
What is there that's going to mitigate the kind of capitalism, unmitigated capitalism that will grow in China?
Any ideas from the rest of you? It haunts me in my sleep.
Wait till they cash all the government bonds that they have.
I've been going to China. I started in China in the 60s, and I've been going regularly since the 80s, and I've seen these absolutely traumatic changes. I mean, you see, you stand on the Kowloon Peninsula and look across at Hong Kong Island, and three of the 10 tallest buildings in the world are on that island. And you go to Shanghai, it's the same kind of thing. Old neighborhoods are just being torn apart. The reliance on extended families is being just destroyed. Rural people from the West are migrating to the cities and being abused by an exploitative work system. And they don't have communism to turn to for values. They don't have Christianity. They don't have Confucianism. Buddhism, hardly. They are a people without a code of ethics to define their lives. So where do you go? I don't know the answer to that, and it torments me. And yet you see these good Chinese people that come, and they come to Augie regularly. We have a Chinese faculty person who comes over and teaches in our language program. They are just the sweetest people. There is this humaneness in them that we all have, and you hope that wins the day. The materialism is there, you know. Earliest teachers that we'd have come over, much simpler than these now. These teachers now going back and measuring their lives by their material possessions as we do. It's very disastrous.
Maybe you just answered my question, but I've been wanting to ask, as a way to get at some of these earlier questions, what the emperor that you described for us yesterday would have thought.
He would have been appalled by Mao. Kangxi would have had no sympathy for Mao at all. Because Mao becomes such a tyrant, and Kangxi prided himself in not being a man of excess. Let me read to you a couple of passages from this book to show you what Mao became. And I say this mostly to give you a sense of the power of power to corrupt. And how disconcerting that is. It's true in the Chinese context. It's true in any context. But this is really scary stuff. Here we go. The real Mao could hardly have been more different from the benevolent sage king portrayed in the authorized memoirs and poster portraits that circulate in China today. To be sure, on first meeting, he could be charming, sympathetic, and casual, setting his visitor at ease to talk freely. But he drew on psychological reserves of anger and contempt to control his followers, manipulating his moods with frightening effect. Relying on the Confucian unwillingness of those around him to confront their superior, he humiliated subordinates and rivals. He undertook self-criticism only to goad others to flatter him, surrounding himself with a culture of abasement. He goes on, I'm just paraphrasing here. Having lost children, a brother, and a wife to war and revolution, he seldom seemed moved by the suffering of lovers, children, and friends any more than he flinched from imposing misery on millions of the faceless masses in pursuit of his economic and political schemes. He understood human suffering chiefly as a way to control people. In politics and personal life alike, he discarded those for whom he had no present use, just as coolly calling them back when he wanted them, if they were still alive. There's a depiction in here. Zhou Enlai, his most loyal subordinate, was suffering from cancer for 2 or 3 years before he passed away. Zhou knew that if he was to survive, he had to get treatment in Europe. He had to get out of China for treatment. And so through an intermediary, he approached Mao and asked if he could take leave to go. Mao would not let him leave the country because he was too important to Mao and Mao's government for a sick leave to save himself from dying. This was a very evil man. Personal habits. Imperial power allowed the ultimate luxury, simplicity. Mao spent much of his time in bed or lounging by the side of a private pool. He loved to swim. In any of the estates you go to, there's an indoor swimming pool. He would swim. Not dressing for days at a time. He ate oily food, rinsed his mouth out with tea, never used a toothbrush. He had wooden tea while he lost all his teeth. And then they take pictures and put the teeth in, you know. And he slept with country girls. This is what I find most insidious. During a 1958 tour of Hunan, Mao's party was followed everywhere by a truckload of watermelons, because he liked watermelons. Mao liked cloth shoes. If he had to wear leather ones for a diplomatic function, he let someone else break them in. He did not bathe, preferring a rub down with hot towels, although this made it hard for Dr. Li to stop the spread of venereal infections among his female companions. He slept on a specially made huge wooden bed that was carried on his private train, set up in his villas, airlifted to Moscow. He exercised sovereignty over clock and calendar. The court worked to Mao's rhythm, and many of its activities took place after midnight. It was not unusual to be summoned to Mao's chambers at 2 or 3 in the morning. He traveled frequently, convening meetings of the nation's leaders wherever he was. He sought to triumph over death through Taoist methods of sex. He followed no schedule except on May Day and National Day, and so on and so forth. Li recounts that Mao, there was a Chinese tradition that sex would prolong life. And Mao, they would have, once a week, they would have dances in the Great Hall of the People. And they would invite young girls to come to the dance. And they had a room off the dance floor. And Mao would dance with these young girls and sometimes take 4 or 5 of them into his bedroom at the time and have sex with them. And Dr. Li said, you cannot do this. You have venereal disease. You'll spread your disease. And Mao would take no precautions. He was an evil, self-serving man. And in his last years, he just lived for himself. You know, he was nocturnal. He'd sleep all day and never get out of his bathrobe. He was one of those evil emperors that you read about in Chinese history. Kangxi would not have liked Mao Zedong. He might have liked him as a young man, but somehow between, there's a disconnect. Before 49, I can identify with this fellow, living in the caves of Yan'an with other people close around him, and then afterwards, the power just corrupted. I remember a trip to Beijing, and I went out, this will be the last comment because it's lunchtime. I went out to see some hutongs. These are the little neighborhoods that are quickly being demolished to build big high-rises in Beijing. But they're walled enclosures, and they go back to Ming Dynasty times. And I asked the person that was with me, a Chinese friend, I said, where did all the communist leaders live once they overran Beijing? And many of them moved to Zhongnanhai, this enclave where the emperors lived. But I said, what about the others? He said, they all moved into the hutong of the old mandarins, the old scholar officials. They didn't live humbly and simply. They moved in, they lived in the best of houses, they now enjoyed the glory and the power and the wealth and the influence that they felt they had earned in the revolutionary experience. And once that happened, the whole place went to pot. You see, they lost their idealism. Why does that happen? It's worth exploring. And we'll do this when we talk about Peter the Great tomorrow. I hope to compare Peter with Kangxi, these two emperors that were contemporary. And then on Thursday, we'll compare Lenin with Mao. Very different people. And I don't much like Lenin either. but we'll explore that and then ask this question, what makes these people great? And does their good outweigh their bad? On the scales of history, should we still revere Mao or just deal with that?
What do you know about the peasants in China right now? I hear there's 800 million peasants now that haven't changed much in their lifestyle at all since this big industrial revolution over there.
That's changing very quickly. As more peasants move to the coast or the big cities to work, producing goods for Walmart, you know, and for us. And the government finally is beginning to pay more attention to peasants and their needs. Still, if you've been to China and you get out into rural China, the difference between 19th century rural China and 21st century Shanghai is just striking. I think their life is getting better. There's a lot of reportage that's being done. I could recommend some books to you that talk about the plight of rural peasants. But I think this is a reality, that their lives are on the upswing. The key is education, as it is in America. And since the Tiananmen massacre in 1989, the Chinese government has infused a lot of money into higher education, and actually middle school education, in ways that are just quite remarkable. And so I think education is one way, this, as is the case here, one way that this will all occur.
I read recently that the peasants are living close to the big cities. Their land is being taken.
Yeah, and there isn't, it's and not even eminent domain. You just take it.
Yeah,
and there are uprisings against
them. But they give them an apartment in the city. So divorce is rampant in China now among these people. Because they get two apartments. They divorce their wife. The wife can get one, they can get one. And people have been married for 50 years or 60 years are getting divorced now because they get two apartments instead of one.
And they rent
one out and live in the other.
I'll never buy a summer home. We'll stick with one house for you. We better let it go at that. I'm out of time. Thank you for your attendance.